the eastern part of the Middle East. The Exodus celebrated on the Passover, the deliverance from Egypt. The giving the law on Mount Sinai is celebrated on Shavuot. We move through the Sinai into Transjordan and during Sukkot as we commemorate the booths in which our fathers dwelt during the long years of the wilderness wanderings. And the New Year's, Rosh Hashanah, and the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, are holidays which are indigenous to the central shrine, the temple in Jerusalem. Purim began in the East, and it is the one holiday which is a creation of that very important Jewry, which lived in the countries which are today Iraq, Iran, and which for many centuries were the central focus of the Jewish intellectual and cultural life. Indeed, if we went back only 50 years ago and visited Baghdad, the third of the four cities in the series on towns in which Jews have lived for over 1,000 years, we would have found ourselves in the midst of a sizable Jewish community, a community somewhat larger than the present Jewish community of Cleveland. In the late 30s and early 40s, it's estimated that of the 250,000 citizens of Baghdad, over 70,000 were Jews. That Jewish community had 36 synagogues, 4 yeshivot, 52 Jewish schools, day schools. It was a pious, active, bustling community consisting mostly of small shopkeepers and artisans, but with a sizable group of government people, bureaucrats, administrators, and people who dealt in international trade. Its practices were traditional, that is rabbinic, halachic, overlaid with a layer of the customs and of the superstitions, which are part and parcel of Jewish life in the Oriental communities. There were no rabbis. The rabbis were called chachams, chachamim, wise men, given the deference that was due them. The great synagogue in Baghdad, which was called the Slat il Gibri, claimed to be built on the spot which had been selected by King Jehoiakim in the year 586 before the Common Era. Jehoiakim was the last king of Judah, who ruled on the throne of King David in Jerusalem at the time when the armies of Babylon under King Nebuchadnezzar came and conquered the city and destroyed its first temple and led the Judean leadership into exile. According to the Baghdadi lore, the place where King Jehoiakim and his courtyards built a synagogue of one kind or another out of materials which they had brought from the temple in Jerusalem was the very place on which their great synagogue had been built, which would make it the original, not only the oldest, but the original synagogue in the world. But of course, this is lore, legend, and not fact. Baghdad is an old city. It was a farming village in that area in central Iraq where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers run for about 50 miles, very close to one another, within 25 or 30 miles of each other. It was a village whose roots have now been traced by archaeologists back to the third millennium before the Common Era. But it remained a small town down till the 8th century of our era, when the Abbasid caliphs of Islam in the year 750 chose Baghdad as their great imperial capital. Now, the very fact that there is this old legend suggests something we tend to overlook, being Western and therefore somewhat parochial in our outlook. And that is that it is a great deal of what we call Judaism was created in and created by Eastern Jews. And that the Jews who lived in that very small area of land, which lies between the two great riverways of West Asia, the Euphrates to the west, the Tigris to the east, at that point in mid-Iraq, where they tend to run close to one another, an area which in antiquity was crisscrossed with canals so that there could be river transportation, between these two rivers, which emptied into the Persian Gulf and therefore provided ship transportation all the way to India and to the Far East. Rivers which ran up the Tigris into Turkey, the Euphrates into Syria, and therefore provided quick transportation towards the Mediterranean, towards the heartlands of Europe, and through, from the Mediterranean, of course, across the lands of the known and established world. When we think of this Jewry, who lived in that part of the world which Jews called Babel, Babylonia, and our tradition calls every empire was centered there in history, Babel. We remember the prophet Ezekiel, the prophet Deutero-Isaiah, who preached to the exiles in the 6th century. Daniel is supposed to have been a courtier at the king, the court of the Babylonian kings, of King Nebuchadnezzar. Later, Nehemiah and then Ezra, who were courtiers to the Persians, who supplanted the Babylonians in the east, were given imperial edicts which allowed them in turn to come back to Judea to rebuild Jerusalem, to build up again its walls, and to establish the Torah as the central constitution of Jewish life. In point of fact, our Torah, as we now have it, is probably a creation of the Jews of Babel, the Jews of the East, who took with them the traditions and some of the scrolls of their past, but who edited while they were in the East, the scroll as we now have it, and who brought it, sent that scroll back to Jerusalem with Ezra around the year 400 before the Common Era. And of course, the beyond Purim, the creativity of this Eastern Jewry did not end with biblical times. That Judaism, which we call rabbinic, the traditional Orthodox Judaism of our own day, was founded in the Holy Land in the first and second centuries. But it flourished particularly in the East, in Babel. And it was in the great Oxfords and Cambridges of this community, in towns called Nisibis, Nehardea, Sura, Pumpedita, all towns within a day or two's journey of modern Baghdad, that the discussions took place and the academic sessions were held, whose records now form the body of what we call the Babylonian Talmud, the basic text of halakhic Judaism. And so we have a great deal to be grateful for the wisdom and for the cultural activity and the cultural creativity of this Judaism. Now, when the Muslims conquered the known world in the 7th century, they first tried to make their imperial capital closer to the Saudi mainland, closer to the Arabian Peninsula, first at Kufa and then at Damascus. But they quickly discovered what all emperors had discovered before them, that if you wanted ease of communication for a landmass which runs from Turkey through Egypt to North Africa and then the other way as far as India, you had to be on the great riverways. And so when the Abbasid caliphs came to power in the year 750 of this era, the great founder of that dynasty established a round fortress as his capital in this old town, just outside the old town of Baghdad. And this became the center for several centuries of control of the known world. Now, there were Jews in the town of Baghdad before 750 of the Common Era. In the Talmud, we hear of a third century sage by the name of Samuel al-Baghdadi. One of the customs of Oriental Jews is to name, use as a defining name, what we might call a last name, the birthplace of a particular individual. So Samuel al-Baghdadi seems to have lived elsewhere. It is clear that he was born in Baghdad. Then in the 8th century, with the establishment of the caliphate in Baghdad, Jewish life quickly began to center in that part of the world. When we Jews look at the world with our democratic prejudices, and I'm all in favor of our democratic prejudices, we tend to be rather smug about countries like England, where concerns of lineage and of blood and a family tree, feudal kinds of concerns still seem to be important. And in doing so, we do a disservice to our own limitations, because there were few communities which were as lineage proud as our own historically. During Talmudic days, the Jews of the Parthian and then of the Sasanian Empire were under the leadership of a man known as the Resh Galuta. Resh means head. Galuta is the Aramaic for galut, exile, the head of the exile or the exilarch. And this man claimed to be, and all of, so did all of his descendants, direct descendants of King David. The Jews were willing to give their authority, their allegiance to a descendant of the house of David, because the house of David was all tied up with the messianic hopes of our people. And the more magnificent the exilarch, the more immediately the people understood the glories which would be theirs once a king of the house of David was reestablished on the ancient throne. Now, King David became king in Jerusalem in the year 1000 before the Common Era. And the last Resh Galuta of Davidic lineage was deposed in Baghdad in the year 1253 of our era, 2,253 years of concern with the lineage of a single dynasty. The Resh Galuta was deposed when the Mongols swept down from Central Asia and overwhelmed the Arab caliph who ruled there. But for that period of time, we paid ceremonial obeisance to a descendant of the House of David, and the House of David became the longest live dynasty ever to be granted authority, suasive or real authority, by any people in recorded history, 2,253 years. There was a great deal of formality associated with the Resh Galuta's court. The number of people who traveled in the Middle East in the 10th, 11th, and 12th centuries have left us diaries which tell us something of the ceremonial of that court. He was crowned. There was a coronation, not unlike the coronation of the kings of England. And at that coronation, people would come and they would bow themselves and present gifts. And the two great leaders of the academies of the time, which were then Sura and Pumpedita, would each come, and much like the Anglican archbishop would, in a sense, invest with his authority the Resh Galuta, the man who would represent the Jews at the court. Now, the Persians and later the Muslims were delighted to have a single representative of the Jews because it facilitated their governance of the self-governing communities which comprised their empire. And the Jews were pleased to have a descendant of the House of David represent them because he personified their messianic expectations. And besides the ceremonial of the court, there was a great ceremonial associated with the great Oxfords and Cambridges of Iraqi Jewish life. The two great communities in the 8th, 9th, and 10th century, two great universities, were Sura and Pumpedita, about 2 days' walk from Baghdad. And there the academies met under the head of a man named Gaon, which means the pride, from a phrase in the Bible, Gaon Yaakov, the pride of Jacob. And they discussed the Talmudic law and drew it together. Now, there was great formality. And so we think of the university as a place where Levi's and sweaters and informal discussions take place. In these academies, the 70 scholars who provided the basis of the faculty of the academy sat in 7 rows of 10 each, and there was an exact order of precedence in each row. And when an issue was being discussed, the senior man in the bottom row spoke first, and then in order the rest of the academy. You can imagine if you were the 70th and the youngest and the least respected, how much weight was given to your voice or what was left for you to say. But there was it was from these academies that the various themes which were of concern to Jewish life were brought together. The Talmud is a jumble. It's a series of shorthand setting downs of the discussions in the earlier academies. But as Jewish life spread under the wide-spreading culture of the Arab world, Jews often found themselves in North Africa, in Cochin, places in southern France and northern Spain, far away from the centers of Jewish life, often without someone who had been trained in these academies. And they needed to have answers to the questions, how do we worship? Whose authority has precedence over what other sages' authority? Whom do we listen to? How do we observe our Jewish tradition? And they would write questions to these two academies. They're called Shailot and Tshuvot, questions and answers. And sometimes the answers which would be sent back by the Gaon and his academy were very simple, one sentence or two sentences or a single paragraph. And sometimes they wrote extended essays, which are the first attempts to draw together the body of Jewish rabbinic Jewish life as defined in a particular area of concern to Jews. And it is the beginning of the process of codification, which was carried on then for the next 1,000 years in our religious tradition. Now, by the 9th century, the Oxford and Cambridge of this Jewry had moved in from the countryside to London, to Baghdad. And by this time, Baghdad becomes the power center and the center of authority for Jewish life, and remains that for as long as really the caliphs in Baghdad assert authority over the Muslim world. It's a very special kind of Judaism. It's a Judaism which was pious and heavily messianic. It is one which was heavily impacted and influenced, of course, by the environment of which it was a part. But one of the most amazing linguistic transformations in the history of our people took place right after the Arab conquest. The Jews of the Middle East until that time had spoken either Aramaic or Greek as the language of daily conversation. But within a generation, they were speaking Arabic. And most of the literature, rabbinic and general, of the next 4 to 10 centuries in the people of that world was written in the Arabic tongue. And Arabic practices began to exert a very strong influence over Jewish life. Since this is Purim, it's interesting that on Purim, a young mother with a child who was 6 months old or a year and a half old, would bring, the day that the Megillah was read, would bring the child to the synagogue. And the child would carry in his little hand a pushka, a little charity box. And the mother, it didn't matter if she was wealthy or poor, would pass around this pushka to everybody in the congregation, and they would take out a coin, and they would drop the coin into the pushka. Now, how did this develop? Well, the first assumption was that since Purim was in the ancient world the gift-giving time, this was a way of the whole congregation to participate in the giving of a gift to a newborn, in a sense, welcoming the newborn into the community. That's what we would like it to have been. But it really goes much deeper and reveals something of the fears and the anxieties and the cultural limitations of this world. The Megillah, which we just heard read, concludes with a letter which Mordecai sends out to all the Jewry of his day, in which he tells them that the 14th day of Adar is to be celebrated as a great feast day, a day of joy, of sending of gifts to one another, and of matanot la'evyonim, and of gifts to the evyonim, which is to the poor. Now, if you take the aleph of evyonim, which is a silent letter, and you transpose the aleph of evyonim to an ayin, which is the other silent letter in the Hebrew alphabet, what you get is, when you read it that way, and gifts to those who are thick-skinned. Now, who are the thick-skinned? The thick-skinned are the demons, the little spirits of the night. And essentially, this was a way of giving money to the demons in order to protect the little child from anything that the demon might be trying to do, which would be to the child's hurt. There was another interesting, very pervasive custom among these Baghdadi Jews. About a half-hour walk from the center of town, you would come to a shrine which was noted because it was in the middle of a tall field of sycamore trees. And there was a cupolate building with a catafalque inside of it, a grave-covered coffin. And this coffin was reputed to be the coffin of a high priest named Joshua ben Yehotzedek. Now, if you don't know who Joshua ben Yehotzedek is, don't feel bad, because very few of us do. But if you look up your biblical history, you'll discover that when the Jews returned from the Babylonian exile at around the year 510, when the first small group came back to Jerusalem, one of the prophets, Haggai, in the name of God, commissions
Joshua ben Yehotzedek, a descendant of the high priest, to rebuild the second temple. And he is the man who was in charge of the carpentry work for this little building, which was the first shrine from which the second temple ultimately grew. And so Joshua ben Yehotzedek is associated with the Zionist, messianist dreams of the Jewish people. And no one has ever explained how Joshua ben Yehotzedek, who lived and died in Jerusalem, happened to be buried in Baghdad. But there his grave is to this day. And on every new moon, the Jews of Baghdad, who had prayers to offer, would come out and offer these prayers at the shrine. In so doing, duplicating a practice which is pervasive in the Muslim world, which is a practice of going to the graves of people who are saints, reputed miracle workers, and offering their prayers to these miracle workers as intercessors who will present their prayers to Allah, to God. Islam is a pure monotheism in its theology. But as it spread throughout the world, it adjusted to the paganisms and to the traditions of the communities in which it found itself, almost all of whom had rich theologies with either many gods, as two gods as among the Zoroastrians, three gods as among the Christians. And it did so by this practice of using these gods, transforming them into Muslim saints, and worshiping there at this altar, at this shrine, in the hope that they would present their prayers to God. And the Jews of Baghdad had not only the shrine of Joshua ben Yehotzedek, with a day or two travel from Baghdad, there was a supposed grave of the prophet Ezekiel, there was a supposed grave of Ezra, and the Jews of Baghdad had an interesting custom, and that is, when a person died, they'd be buried in the cemetery just outside the city. But very often, at a pilgrimage time, the family would exhume the body and take the body out to one of these great shrines and bury the body near the grave of Ezra, near the grave of Ezekiel or of Joshua, because somehow that was the place where resurrection would first take place. That was the holy place where these people would in fact be protected. And such is the interplay, the interconnection of the Muslim and of the Jewish tradition, that throughout the Middle East and throughout North Africa, Muslims often came to the shrines of Jewish saints to offer their prayers, and Jews often went to the shrines of Muslim saints to offer their prayers. There was an old tradition so that you went to whoever was the local holy man, to his grave, and sought there the miracle, the answer to your prayers, which was your hope. Now, after the great heyday of Babylonian and Baghdadi Jewry in the 8th, 9th, and 10th, and 11th centuries, Baghdad fell into hard times. As the Muslim empire expanded, it expanded beyond the ability of Baghdad to control what was happening in the extremities. Soon the Abbasid caliphs had another Abbasid prince on the throne in Egypt who declared his independence. What happened to the Muslim empire is not unlike what happened to the Roman empire, which split up between East and West. It split up between Baghdad and Cordoba. And then other caliphs arose in various parts of the world. In North Africa, a Berber dynasty ultimately conquered all of North Africa, and then Egypt, the Fatimids. There was the interruption of the 200-year crusade by Christian Europe against the Middle East, which disrupted the economy and, of course, communication. And Baghdad became more and more a provincial center rather than a great imperial center. And in the 13th century, it was overrun and pillaged by the Mongols. In the 14th, 15th, and 16th century, it was a bone of contention between Shiite caliphs who came out of Persia, Turkish and other peoples who came down from Turkey, Syrian monarchs who came in from the West. And it was a difficult period for Baghdad and for the Jews of Baghdad. And since we're at Purim, it's interesting to note that in Baghdad, there was not one Purim, like ours this week on the 14th of Adar, but there were three Purims. There was a Purim in the summer on the 11th of Ab, and there was a Purim in the late fall in Tevet, on the 16th of Tevet. And these Purims celebrated the deliverance of the Baghdadi Jewry, the unexpected deliverance from a danger. And it's interesting that in both cases, the danger from which they escaped was a danger we have come to recognize in our own day. the danger of Shiite fundamentalism erupting from Iran, from Persia. In the 16th century, a Persian Shiite dynasty, the Safavid, gained control of Damascus and of Baghdad, that whole part of the world. And the Jewries of these communities were threatened with extinction. And ultimately, the Ottoman Turks, under a sultan named Muhammad, in 1533, conquered the city of Baghdad from the Shiite Safavid dynasty, and ever after the Jews celebrate the day of his conquest as a great day of deliverance of Purim. And 105 years later, in 1638, 3 years after another Persian Shiite caliph by the name of Shumit had gained control over Baghdad, the Ottomans under Murad came down and reconquered the city, and this became the third Purim celebrated in Baghdad. Jewish life managed to survive the Middle Ages with difficulty, but it survived. And then in the 19th century, things began to look up for the community of Baghdad. There was the beginning of colonialism in the Middle East, which meant the beginning of larger scale commerce. People began to be able to move out from their narrow narrow province. And throughout the 19th century, Jewish life began to grow in numbers and in prosperity in that part of the world. And then in 1905, when the Young Turk Revolution in Ankara overthrew the Ottoman sultans and established freedom of religion and freedom of association within the Turkish Empire, the Jews began a very short-lived period of freedom and of prosperity. Three Jews of Baghdad were elected to the parliament in Ankara, and Jews were able to move into all areas of the government and of economic life in that society. And this process continued after the First World War, when the British gained a mandate over Iraq in order to protect its oil resources for the West. And Jews had a period in the first three decades of this century of prosperity and of opportunity. Western groups like the Alliance Israélite Universelle and some British groups began to establish modern schools for the Jews of Baghdad. Literacy in terms of ability to speak Western languages increased markedly. A number of the children, particularly the boys of Baghdad, were sent to school in England and in other parts of Europe. And there was a Jewry which was coming alive to the 20th century, but still one in which observance was totally pious, totally traditional. And then in 1932, bad times began to settle on Baghdad and on Iraq. The British gave up their mandate to the Arabs, and the Arabs immediately began to take away the privileges which the Jews had enjoyed, or rather the freedoms which the Jews had enjoyed. The Jews were not the only ones to be discriminated against. This is the beginning of the period of the discrimination against the Armenians in Iraq and against the Kurds in Iraq. We often think of the decimation of the Jews of these great centers in the Middle East as due entirely to the rise of Israel. This is not so. It has to do with the peculiar ways in which Arab nationalism manifested itself. The West imposed boundaries on these countries. These were all countries in which there was a tradition of what's called millet governance, that is self-governing by the various minorities which comprise the community, largely governing themselves in either special areas of the city or special parts of the countryside. And now suddenly there was a central government which was claimed to be local nationalist, and all of these minorities were suddenly a danger to the central government. And because the British had been the colonial oppressors in Iraq, the new Iraqi nationalist government turned more and more to Germany, which had also colonial ambitions in the Middle East, for its support and for its arms. And from 1933 on, the German ambassador in Baghdad began to disseminate the most vicious kinds of anti-Semitic materials. After all, he was a Nazi. That was part of his task. And Iraqi newspapers, Iraqi literary groups, the universities expelled their Jews, denigrated their Jews in a way which was uncommon in the Muslim world. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion became required reading in a number of the schools.
And long before the issue was Zionism, the issue was nationalism, and the issue was German-imported anti-Semitism. And things became increasingly difficult for this community up and until the Second World War. And during the Second World War, particularly in its early stages, the leaders of Iraq tried to align themselves with the Axis. And there were, in May of 1941, violent pogroms in Baghdad against the Jews of Baghdad, and hundreds were wounded. There were some 30 who were killed. It's estimated that $10 million worth of Jewish institutional buildings and of Jewish businesses were looted, fired, destroyed. And this marks really the beginning of the end of this stable and organized community. The British managed to reimpose order with their troops, but it was a standoff. And at the end of the war, with the vote in the United Nations to establish a Jewish state in Palestine, Iraq became one of the most intransigent of the opponents of the Jewish state. It still is at war with Israel. Almost everyone else who was in that war has at least had a ceasefire mentality since that time. And once the 47 came about, the Iraqi government imposed an embargo on the Jews of, on the exit of the Jews of Iraq from Iraq. Such was the difficulty of their lives that about 20,000 fled on foot across the mountains into Iran. It's hard to imagine today Iran being looked upon as a safe haven, but it was under the Shah. And then about 3 years later, in 1951, tired of trying to suppress this sizable Jewish community, 130 or 140,000 Jews lived in the province of Baghdad alone, the Iraqi government decided that the simpler way was to give the Jews a choice: exit and expropriation. You give me all that you have, I'll let you go out with a single suitcase, but I'll let you go out. And 116,000 Jews left within 2 months, took up this bargain. And by 1953, there were less than 2,000 Jews in a community which just 5 years before had numbered over almost 80,000. Why the few who remained remain, no one really knows. Some obviously wanted desperately to hold on to their money or to their property, but their property was soon expropriated and they had to live on what meager savings they had. And there were show trials and arbitrary arrests, so that by 1985, less than 100 Jews live in the city of Baghdad, where in 1945, there were nearly 80,000. Iraq has not been an easy country for anyone to live in the last 40 years. There's a movie out called The Killing Ground, and Iraq has been a killing ground. Not just for Jews. Indeed, most Jews have been fortunate to escape with their lives. But there's been a nearly 35-year war with the Kurds in the mountains to the east. There's been a nearly 35-year war of attrition against the Armenians in their settlements to the north. And there's been now the nearly four-year-old war with Iran on the east. And each of these military actions, these killing ground actions, have been initiated by the government in Baghdad. Iran did not make war against Iraq. Iraq made war against Iran. The Kurds did not fight for independence against Iraq. Iraq began to try and destroy the Kurdish and the Armenian communities. And so the Jews have not suffered inordinately. We've not been singled out, but we have suffered. Suffered greatly in a great community in which Jews have survived for well over 1,000 years is now not only a less than a shadow of its former self. Is there a future for this community? Well, if you believe in Purim, perhaps there is. Suddenly there are miracles and genocide is reversed and all works out well in the end. And stranger things in Purim have happened in the Middle East, which is a world in which stability and security are rare, in which sudden changes of
based upon the willfulness or the sudden decision of one or another of the leaders is more the order of the day than otherwise. But one would be forced to say that given the 50 years of propagandizing, of anti-Semitic stereotyping, not only in the traditional ways of the Middle East, which are to consider anyone who is not a Muslim an infidel, dini, who is to be tolerated but restrained and whom many restrictions are to be placed. Added to this, the importation into countries like Iraq of the worst of the anti-Semitic traditions of Europe, you have a witch's brew, which suggests that it may be a long time before the days of sadness will turn to days of joy, yagon simcha, evel yom tov, the days of mourning, will turn, as the Megillah says, into days of festival and of joy. Amen.